2-0699 Columbus Park Housing Corporation versus City of Kenosha. Representing the City of Kenosha is Robert I. Demez.
Thank you. May it please the court, Robert Demez appears on behalf of the City of Kenosha. 45 years ago, when the engineers and scientists of Milwaukee sought an exemption for their property, this court said that while an organization's activities might serve a public purpose, the decision to allow an exemption must be clearly spelled out in the legislature. Good citizenship alone doesn't entitle anyone to an exemption. The City of Milwaukee reminded us in its amicus brief that it's not just this court that has laid out the rules. The legislature in 70.109 has said the same thing. It is in that context that we have to look at 70.11 sub 4, which provides an exemption for property owned and exclusively used by a benevolent association. The last sentence of that subsection says that if such property is leased, it remains exempt only if it meets the requirements of the preamble of 70.11 and if the lessee does not discriminate on the basis of race. I'd like to begin with a discussion of the second requirement in the preamble, the lessee identity test. The city submits that that test should have been dispositive. The city believes it is a straightforward test from an analytical standpoint. It offers pretty much a bright line test. It requires an identification of the lessee and then asks if that lessee would fit within one of the enumerated categories of exemptions that follow in 70.11. Analytically, it is akin to the third test, whether the lessee discriminates on the basis of race. You have to first start by identifying who the lessee is, and then you ask a specific question of that lessee. Now, I would submit that the Court of Appeals didn't do that, and that was the fundamental problem with their decision. The Court of Appeals began with the assumption that the legislature intended to give Columbus Park an exemption. It is certainly true that the city stipulated that Columbus Park is a benevolent association, but that's only the threshold requirement for an exemption. When you lease the property,
what's wrong with the approach that let's not get super technical about this, let's look at it in terms of the realities of the situation? And the realities of the situation would be that the housing authority, the city housing authority, is directly involved in this process. The housing authority is providing subsidies to the people that are living in these properties, and therefore we can't ignore that connection between the housing authority and the people living on the or in the premises. And that the other approach is way too technical. What's wrong with that argument?
The other approach isn't a technical approach. The other approach is what the legislature said the test is. What is the role of the Kenosha Housing Authority in this situation? It provides vouchers to the tenants. It requires the tenants to attend an orientation session. It inspects the property once before they move in and then once every year thereafter, and it requires the tenants to report any changes in their income. The housing authority is simply the conduit through which the federal rental subsidies are being funneled to the landlord. The Kenosha Housing Authority has no possessory rights in this property. The test focuses on the lessees and says, who are the lessees, and would they qualify for an exemption? I think the role of the housing authority is only relevant if you conclude that it somehow makes the housing authority the lessee. What I submit is the implication of the Court of Appeals decision. Columbus Park was quick to point out, well, that's not exactly what the Court of Appeals said. They said it was simply a relevant consideration. Well, it's a relevant consideration on what inquiry? What is it relevant to? Is it relevant on identifying who the lessee is? Or is it relevant on whether that lessee would qualify for an exemption? I would submit it's relevant on neither. Simple fact from the city's standpoint is that the residents of these properties, they are the lessees, and there is no category of exemption for
Counselor, excuse me right there. That's a problem that bothers me. Do the occupants have to be the lessees? What if they didn't have a lease? What if they were just required by the owners of the property to pay a stipend to the general works of this benevolent society? Do the occupants have to be a lessee? Can't they be the guests of the owners to further the owners' benevolent purposes?
I would imagine that there are some circumstances that you could create in which the occupants of property would be characterized as something other than lessees. If the relationship between the occupant and the benevolent association cannot fairly be categorized as a lease, I don't think the preamble applies. I think that's why, for example, when Columbus Park worries about the retirement homes and the residents of a retirement home or the residents of a nursing home, they say, well, they'll lose their exemptions because they're there pursuant to a lease. I don't think that every residency agreement can fairly be characterized as a lease. It was stipulated in this case that these properties were leased to these residents. But in a nursing home case, the individual is a patient. The relationship there has a residency component, but I would suggest that the agreement there is not fairly that of a lease. The primary purpose in a nursing home would be to receive the nursing care, the assisted living, and so forth.
Well, in your view, then, could the Benevolent Association change its relationship with the people who occupy these units so they're still able to create affordable housing for those who cannot afford it, but not put them in the position of being a lessee of the property?
I don't think they could do that and still get federal rental subsidies because, as I understand the Section 8 program, there's a requirement that they sign a lease, the tenant, okay, sign a lease with the landlord.
So they're stuck on Section 8 in regard to the status.
In this case, because that is their mission, they are working with Section 8, and that has specific requirements, one of which is a lease.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
The public housing authority that did exactly the same thing wouldn't have any problem. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But a non-public housing authority, from what I hear you say, they cannot lease to any one of the 5.5 million people in Wisconsin and still retain, unless they come under 4G, I believe it is.
In 4G, which deals with rehabilitating for purposes of sale, if they lease that property pending the sale, I think they would face the same problems. The lessee isn't going to qualify for an exemption if the lessee owned the property. 4G, for example, when those new homeowners move into their homes they have acquired, they don't get an exemption. They have to pay real estate taxes.
Well, I understand that. But on a temporary basis, at least theoretically, you might be able to rely on 4G. But if you're not able to rely on 4G and able to meet all the conditions in 4G, I hear your argument to be there is no one of the 5.5 million people of Wisconsin who can lease from a non-public housing authority in connection with Section 8 and not destroy the tax exemption of the non-public housing authority.
I believe that's the plain meaning of the statute, Your Honor. With respect to public housing authorities, the legislature has two statutes which apply. Chapter 66 says that they are subject to payments in lieu of taxes. And then there's the exemption under sub 18 in 70.11. I think this Court has indicated that the way you harmonize the statutes in that case is you give a liberal construction in favor of exemption because they have to, or they're subject to, a payment in lieu of taxes under the other statute. There is no payment in lieu of taxes provision for nonprofit benevolent associations whose mission is to provide Section 8 housing.
Isn't the real, if you go to the substance rather than the form, isn't the lessee here really the Kenosha Housing Authority? Don't they process these tenants?
They administer the federal rental subsidies.
Right.
They don't have any possessory rights.
No, I understand that.
They're not the ones who get evicted if there's a non-payment of rent.
That's right.
In the traditional sense, a lease the primary focus of a lease is the transfer of possession from the landlord to the tenant for a period of time. And I don't think under any stretch of that definition could you conclude that the Kenosha Housing Authority, who merely administers federal rental assistance for what the city submits are the real lessees, I don't see how the Kenosha Housing Authority could be deemed the lessee.
So what else does the Kenosha Housing Authority does? Does it advertise for the tenants? Does it process whether they're eligible for federal subsidy to Columbia to Columbus Park Housing if they're leased this property? I mean, what's the relation of Kenosha Housing?
The Kenosha Housing Authority does that for all tenants who are seeking subsidized housing under the Section 8 program, which is open to both commercial, for-profit landlords and nonprofit landlords. Yes, they inspect the properties before the tenants move in to assure that there's compliance with the minimum housing standards. The city does that from time to time in the Board of Health. The Housing Authority works with the prospective tenants. They have to attend its orientation program. They have to cooperate with the Housing Authority as far as any adjustments on the subsidies. But
so it's a tripartite kind of lease.
I believe, Your Honor, the lease is there are two agreements. There's a lease between the landlord and the tenant, and then the Housing Authority has a separate agreement with the landlord which covers the subsidies.
And a separate agreement with the tenant as to what the tenant has to do to qualify?
That's correct.
You've got a third party in there, let's put it that way.
You have a third party in there, and in the same sense that in Medicare and Medicaid, you have a third party in the relationship between the physician and the patient. But that doesn't make the federal government the patient. The patient is the patient. In this case, the lessee is the person who resides in these properties. I think the Court of Appeals error. It suggested that these tenants couldn't afford to pay market rate rents without federal subsidies. That may be true, but what the legislature has said is when you lease the property, the test is whether the lessee would qualify for an exemption if it owned the property. And clearly, impoverished people who own property are still subject to real estate taxes. I don't think it matters that the tenants are, in a sense, the object of Columbus Park's tax-exempt activity. That is not relevant on the question that the legislature has chosen, which is, would the lessee qualify for an exemption?
Well, but the issue I think that your opposition raises is, look, lessee is ambiguous. And therefore, we have to look, and I think the other questions from some of my colleagues, and then look at the legislative intent when deciding whether they meet the requirement under 7011. So you think in this instance that the word lessee, or I could say tenant, but let's just stick with lessee, is ambiguous?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
But the see, when you get a third party, you have the usual lease, you go and you rent or a tenant, you have a contract between a landlord and a tenant. Is that the case here?
There is that contract.
But then there's another criteria, isn't there? Isn't there another level? And that's where the housing authority gets involved?
The housing authority has a separate agreement with the landlord, and there's an agreement between the housing authority and the tenant. But there is a document that can only be defined as a lease between the landlord and the resident. And Your Honor, brought up suggested the term is ambiguous. Respectfully, I would remind the Court, this Court has said ambiguities get construed against an exemption. So to the extent that the term is ambiguous, I don't think that advances Columbus Park's position. The legislative intent that we are looking at here, I don't think we can presuppose that the legislature wanted to give Columbus Park an exemption. We can presuppose the legislature intended that benevolent associations, if they met the other requirements, would get an exemption. But there's no separate criteria for nonprofit, public housing, benevolent associations.
What's the motivation for the city here? One, of course, the obvious is to get taxes, to have tax revenue. But it seems to me that the city and other governmental entities have a strong interest in providing suitable housing for low income, which is a very vital interest of any city. So are there other ramifications to this decision other than the providing or not providing of low-income housing? Or is this it? I mean, is this just the city wants that you've got two interests? You know, the city of Kenosha has two interests, getting money, which is a real valid interest, and providing low-income housing, which is a real valid interest. Is this just a matter of one superseding the other here, or are there other ramifications?
I think your Honor's question presupposes that there would be no nonprofit public housing if they had to pay real estate taxes. I don't think there's...
No, I presuppose there's never enough. That might be a wrong presupposition, but that's my presupposition. There's never enough low-income housing.
That may be, but when Your Honor speaks of what's the city's motivation here, the city is attempting to enforce what the legislature has said are the tax laws. The legislature says we can't give exemptions to people who do a good thing for Kenosha just because we'd like them to do that good thing.
But in 1998, I think there were, 16 properties or something. Four of them were not taxed by the city of Kenosha. It is absolutely clear that they didn't qualify under 4G because there are four conditions that have to be met. Did the city make a mistake then?
The properties that were being rehabilitated not for purposes of sale, but rather for ultimately for purposes of leasing. It was the city's position that the benevolent purpose, and this involved getting high school students to do the carpentry and the prisoners on work release were also participating. We felt that that was the benevolent purpose. That qualified them as a benevolent association. The properties weren't being leased. They were being used exclusively by the benevolent association for its benevolent purpose, and that's why I'm quite sure that's why exemptions were given.
Well, it seemed to me if you win this case, I think there would be nonprofit housing authorities all over the state that would just simply say to the city, you take over. Either that or we have to have more money coming in from our tenants, our lessees, because now we have to pay property taxes.
Or it would come from the feds.
Exactly. I mean,
the money's got to come from somewhere to pay those taxes that weren't being paid before.
And the money now is coming a combination from the tenants and from the federal subsidies. And I don't think we can assume that nonprofit public housing entities are simply going to throw up their hands because they have to pay taxes. For-profit landlords have to pay taxes too.
That are in the same business, right? That are in Section 8. I mean, there are people that, did I misinterpret when I read the briefs or the memo?
It is not part of the stipulation of the facts that for-profit landlords participate in Section 8 program. Section 8 program is available to all landlords, for-profit and non-profit.
How is the Section 8 subsidy set? Is it set looking at all of the expenses of the landlord? Or what's the process that's used in setting the subsidy? I know it looks at the market value of the premises being rented, but does that in any way include the expenses of the landlord?
It's my understanding that it does, Your Honor. The City of Milwaukee cited a case in its amicus brief. And I can't recall the name of the case, but I believe it was from New York, which indicated that there's a contemplation that real estate taxes would be paid by the landlord. And market rate rents, they apply to both for-profit landlords who clearly have to pay taxes and non-profit. So it's not a different rate depending on who you are, it's market rates.
So your answer to Justice Prosser's question as far as public housing, that if this court, now, first of all, I think that we can't do a good thing. In other words, we have to look at the legal argument. The point is that if I'm correct here, is that the authority could simply list these taxes as part of the expense which they would be getting back. Is that the argument?
That would be my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, there are three, as I understand it, requirements here. One is that the lessee be eligible for tax exemption, right?
Correct.
We're discussing that. Two, that the rental income be used for specified expenses. And three, exclusive use of the property by the benevolent association, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
All right. So do you want to talk about any of the other two?
Certainly, Your Honor. With respect to the aggregate accounting position of the Court of Appeals when that spoke of the rent use, problem with the Court of Appeals approach that you can apply the excess of rental income from one property to the maintenance and debt reduction of another is that it ignores the language of the preamble, which is entirely in the singular. The nouns are singular, the pronouns, the articles. Leasing a part of the property does not render it taxable. Clearly, property can be understood in the collective sense, but in the context of the preamble, I think it's clear that the legislature was contemplating a property-by-property analysis. That same preamble goes on to speak about the lessee identity test, and I think it's clear that that test is to be applied property by property. For example, in Deutsch's Land, if the Benevolent Association had leased Old Heidelberg Park for the winter months to another Benevolent Association such that it would, standing alone, qualify for an exemption on that property, I don't think it loses it because the Bavarian Inn is a for-profit entity on another parcel of its property. I think the only sensible construction of that is to do it on a property-by-property basis.
Counselor, in that regard, what if the Benevolent Association bought a five-story high-rise that had a lot of apartments within it, and one by one they redid those apartments, and so maybe halfway through the project, half of them were finished, and so they leased them in the same way they did the units that we're talking about here? Would you then believe there ought to be an assessment of the value of that building piece by piece, or would the whole building still be exempt, or would the whole building lose its exemption under your analysis of that section of the statute?
As I understood this court in Deutsch's Land, they would be entitled to a partial exemption. They would lose the exemption on those portions which they have leased, which do not meet the criteria of the preamble. They could retain their exemptions on the remainder of the property so long as they were meeting the remaining requirements for a benevolent association.
Okay, so you wouldn't even... Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Okay.
Your time is up. Do you just want to say a short sentence on exclusive use, or you think that was adequately covered?
I think it's covered in the brief. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you,
Mr. Dumais. Attorney David L. Kinneman, representing the Columbus Park Housing Corporation. Mr. Kinneman.
May it please the Court, my name is David Kinneman, and I am appearing for Columbus Park Housing. With me on the briefs are Anthony Tomaselli, who is here at table with me, and David Swanson. We are all of the firm of Quarles and Brady. Let me turn to what I view as the major thrust of the city's argument in this case, and it has been said, Mr. Dumais has said it, that Columbus Park Housing, or more appropriately, the tenants of Columbus Park Housing, fail the lessee or tenant identity test in the leasing language in the introductory phrase of Section 7011. I think that it is fair to say that the city's posture in this case is truly novel, given the very long-standing presence of leasing language in subsection 4 of the statutes and since 1984 in the introductory phrase. There has been leasing language in the benevolent exemption statute since going back to the revised statutes of 1878 at least. The more or less modern version of the language dates from 1931. And in 1984, that more or less modern version of the language was taken out of sub 4 and put into the introductory phrase, arguably to have it apply to a wider variety of subsections of the statute. Never in the long history of that provision has a taxing authority sought to turn it directly against the benevolent activities of an organization that otherwise meets the requirements of subsection 4 and against the charitable class of beneficiaries that are served by such an organization. I would like to take a couple of seconds just to recap what the stipulated and undisputed facts are in this case. That, first of all, Columbus Park Housing is federally tax exempt. It is a benevolent association within the meaning of 7011 sub 4. That's been stipulated. It operates without gain or profit to private persons. At no time has it used its property for pecuniary profit. It owns the properties at issue. It has all of its properties occupied or ready for occupancy by low-income families on the relevant assessment dates in 1988 and 1999, and that many of its tenants would otherwise be homeless. Further, it is an undisputed fact that Columbus Park Housing does not discriminate on the basis of race. So we turn to the proper interpretation.
Mr. Kinnaman, let me stop you there, if I might. There was reference before the stipulation, and you're just talking now about the stipulation. Does the stipulation indeed make it clear that there is a lease between the person occupying the premises and Columbus Park?
I think that it probably does, Justice Crux. It may refer to them as tenants. I don't know whether it specifically says that the occupants lease the premises, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did.
Well, how do you get around, then, the language in the statute, in the preamble, that relates directly to the identity of the lessee and talks about the requirement that that lessee, if that individual or corporation owned the property, would have to be exempt itself?
Again, I think you are at the crux of the case, and I think that it rests on the approach that was taken by the Court of Appeals, and that is that the leasing language in the introduction is intended to be applied to leases with for-profit entities or to leasing activities that are carried on for pecuniary gain. In Deutsches Land, that certainly seems to have been the thrust of this Court's opinion at page 93. The difference here is that Columbus Park's activities, its leasing activities, are part and parcel of its benevolent activities. And its benevolent activities consist of making housing available to very low-income persons, all of whom are below the poverty level.
And that include the director, too?
The executive director is the only exception, Justice Wilcox. And in her case, she is also a resident manager of the properties, and Columbus Park deems it necessary for her to reside on-site on the premises. So by the benevolent activities consisting of making the leases, with the exception of the executive director, available in to these very low-income persons who otherwise would not qualify to rent housing, they qualify because they qualify under the Section 8 program. And I think that it is extremely important to recognize, and Columbus Park has never said that the housing authority itself was the tenant on the property, but certainly consistent, we have argued throughout, and the Court of Appeals followed this line of reasoning, that the involvement and implication of the housing authority as proxy for HUD are essential ingredients to the tenants, these low-income tenants, being able to have rental housing. Furthermore, Columbus Park rehabs its facilities. It goes in, it acquires blighted housing, and using volunteer labor, high school students under the Carpenters Home Improvement Program and county jail prisoners under the Work Release Program, using that volunteer labor, which is really, these are really training programs, they go in, they gut the buildings and reconstruct them so that by the time they are leased to these low-income tenants, you have sanitary, safe, decent, affordable housing.
In there, your opposition indicated, yes, on a question from one of my colleagues here, that the reason we gave an exemption there because we thought that that in itself was benevolent. In other words, the prisoners, the students working, and that's how they created, and that was a question I think Justice Prosser asked. But the main concern is the language of the statute itself, which I think you're – so I think the taxing entity is aware of, the good works. It's a question of whether or not the statutory language would meet this exemption you're asking for.
I think that the answer to the question is that the statute is entitled to a strict but reasonable construction. The Court of Appeals held that the construing it in such a way as to turn the leasing language in the introduction around and hurl it back at the very objects of charitable, who are the objects of the charitable activity, was not a reasonable reading. And this Court has had some excellent language on the whole subject of strict construction. I want to just quote you a sentence from Columbia Hospital Association versus City of Milwaukee that appears at page 668. Which the Court said, a strict construction is nonetheless a construction, and an exemption statute need not be given an unreasonable construction or the narrowest possible construction. So I think what we return to in the final analysis is what is the language in the preamble or in the introductory phrase really directed against? And I would submit that that language, as the Court of Appeals held, is really directed against for-profit leases and commercial advantage. Here, Columbus Park Housing's leasing activity does not operate in the black. In fact, it has had to have charitable contributions in order to cause its program to break even.
Well, suppose they rented to not anyone that came through Kenosha Housing, but anyone that qualified, which they may set up their own standards for how much money the person made per month. And they didn't, they weren't doing this in terms of providing housing for low-income people. And they operated in the red. They didn't make enough money to cover their expenses. Would they fall under 70.114?
I don't believe they would, because I
so
think
what's the difference between the two examples? Of both cases, you have tenants who are in the building for their own personal and commercial uses. And I don't mean uses in that, but they're all profit-making entities, that is, all these tenants. So what's the difference?
I think that where the building is occupied by, whether it's Joe Doak's CPA or IBM's service office or whatever, those lease arrangements clearly would be implicated by the introductory language. They are entered into with the expectation of profit. They are entered into with for-profit entities. Now, you posed another question, and maybe I misunderstood it, that regarding if you had tenants and you didn't precisely have a requirement that you be renting to persons below the poverty level.
Right.
And you were doing this, again, with the expectation of gain. I don't believe that that would be covered by the exemption. I think that what we're dealing with here and what the Court of Appeals found was that this is a very fact-specific situation. Here you have a program where all the tenants, the very fiber of the organization is directed at dealing with low-income persons and attempting to raise them up and starting that with the idea that they're entitled to a safe and decent place to live.
Suppose I was renting to people who had some disability or illness, and I'm providing special services in the building for that, and there are leases. And these people are charged high rents, and they all can afford to pay for it. But there's a benevolent purpose of for disabled and in some manner disadvantaged people. Now, is that none of these tenants are tax-exempt entities? Am I going to get a property tax exemption? And I'm not making enough. I'm not making money. I'm in the red.
Under the city of Kenosha's view, you would not be entitled to a tax exemption, and that gets us to the list of...
Yeah, well, mine is very different. I'm having...
You're not talking about a assisted living facility?
No.
But you're providing services.
Oh, yeah, I've got wide doors, I've got ramps all over, I've got emergency bells in all the apartments, I've got emergency bells in the bathroom, I've got cords for emergency, I've got showers that are designed for disabled people, which a lot of hotels now have, at least in certain rooms. So that's what I mean by special. I'm not getting into the retirement nursing home assisted living, residential rehabilitation, none of that.
So these are...
I am running a special kind of apartment unit. And I'm doing good because these people need special accommodations and I'm giving it to them and I'm not making any money. And they're not low-income people.
If these are disabled persons, if they meet the definition of persons who have disabilities, I would submit that the facility should be exempt under sub 4. I think that is akin to the retirement communities, Milwaukee Protestant Home, Friendship Village, St. John's Lutheran Church facility up in Bloomer, that have all been held by the appellate courts to be entitled to an exemption as a home for the aged. Homes for the aged, assisted living.
Isn't there a difference there, counsel, in that you're talking about an occupancy fee rather than a lease arrangement where you're paying rent based on a lease? For instance, when you go into a hospital, You're not leasing that room. You're paying a fee for occupying the room while you're there. So isn't that a major difference?
I think that there is not a great deal of difference between the arrangements with retirement homes for the aged, retirement communities, assisted living facilities for the elderly, because, first of all, many of the arrangements, or at least in a number of cases, the arrangements are denominated leases. That was the facts in St. John's Lutheran Church. In other cases, where you had a residency agreement, this is the way the document was denominated, in the Marshall and Ilsley Bank of First National Bank of West Bend versus Episcopal Homes Management, the court said this creates a landlord-tenant arrangement. This is tantamount to a lease. So I think that one of the major issues that if this court were to adopt the city's view of the case is that you have an implicit repeal or impairment of a large number of other exemptions that have been recognized either by specific statutory language or by judicial decision. And on my visual over there, we've listed those that we think would be implicated. Obviously, some more than others, but the common ingredient is occupancy for consideration, which is the definition of rent. And where do you stop?
Well, you stop with the words, the word lease. And as Justice Crooks indicated, I'm just looking at, again, you know, nursing home. My mother has been in and out of a nursing home, and there was no lease. As he said, you paid a fee. And most of those, you don't lease a camp. I want to run through those, but I think unless you're telling us that the language implied or had that there was a lease, and that is, I think that's the crux, as you pointed out, of this case.
I agree with that. I think that the Episcopal Homes Management decision, the Court of Appeals, was quite clear that it would look at the realities of the situation rather than how a document was denominated in determining how it would be treated. And there they held that a retirement community residency agreement was a lease and that the tenants were entitled to the protections of the statutes that applied to tenants. I would concede that admission agreements in nursing homes are less directed at occupancy of specific space, but I would also point out that in many retirement homes, the occupancy is very specific as to unit. And that may also be true of some of the others where leases are employed. If a church parsonage or clergy housing is offered other than free, and there is some sort of a lease or a rental arrangement, that arguably is a lease.
Counsel, you indicate that lease and rental are the same thing. I mean, a rental contract is synonymous with a lease?
I think it is, yes.
I wonder why. That makes sense to me, but I wonder why they use the different terms. The contract here is a rental contract. The stipulation, as I read it, did not refer to the term lessee, but rather occupant or tenant. Is that of any significance?
I think that is not of significance. I think that, again, you look at the realities of the arrangement. I would point out that this was, you know, again, in the Episcopal Homes Management case where the Court of Appeals had occasion to consider it, they said we're not going to judge merely by the form. We're going to look at the substance of the arrangement. And I think that part of the problem is that what we have in Section 7011, the statute was originally adopted in the 1849 session of the legislature. It has been around for more than 150 years. And in the Columbia Hospital case, this court had some interesting things to say about that. The contention was made by the city of Milwaukee that because housing for interns of a hospital was not specifically enumerated in the statute, that therefore, applying all the usual strict construction rules and presumptions, there should be no exemption. And the court said this: if Section 7011 were a comprehensive scheme of exemptions enacted substantially at the same time, so that we could say the legislature in fact had the whole scheme in mind at its enactment, there would be some merit in the city's argument. However, while the exemptions are extensive and grouped together and require the application of the peri materia rule, we think the rule expressio unius est exclusio alterius is not necessarily to be used in construing the statute. I think what the court is saying is this statute is an aggregation of accretions and relictions and patches and cobbles going on over 150 years. It is not a seamless web. It is not the Uniform Commercial Code. And in reading it or any of its language or any parts of it, this Court will frequently be called upon to engage in the task of construction of the statute. And I think that that is precisely where we find ourselves in this case.
Let's assume, counsel, that we reject the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the lessee identity clause of the preamble language here, and that because the individual Section 8 tenants here are not themselves tax exempt, that your client has a problem.
Yes.
Is that a fair characterization?
It is a fair characterization, and I would submit that.
If I could, before you submit your thought, if I could finish my question,
okay.
Let's operate under that assumption. And would that problem then be solved if Columbus Park were to lease to another nonprofit, a separate nonprofit, which would then sublease to the Section 8 tenants, the low-income tenants? Would that solve the statute?
I don't think it would, because I think that the language in the introduction talks about the lessee entity being exempt under this section. And in order to be exempt under this section, if you lease, you get thrown right back around into the introduction, so that presumably the same issue would confront the sublessee as confronts Columbus Park.
Well, suppose it leased to a public housing authority.
I don't know what the answer is to that, but I suspect that since public housing authorities are also granted an exemption in sub 18, that you have the same problem. And in fact, we think that if you adopt the city's view of the law in this case, that the leases entered into by a public housing authority are going to disqualify it under sub 18. Admittedly, there is another statute in the municipal code, section 66-1201, that also has an exemption, but that just creates a conflict, it seems to me, between the two statutes.
But, Counselor, under 70.11 in the preamble, the exemption granted under subsection 18 to the property of a public housing authority is not subject to any further conditions. It's simply exempt. So I guess to go back to the question that was posed to you, is it necessarily so that Columbus Park could not continue with its benevolent mission in another form if we don't happen to agree with the Court of Appeals' interpretation under the statute?
I think there are serious problems, because there is absolutely no guarantee that the housing authority would come in and act as a sub-lessee.
The ramifications of this decision as to other entities throughout the state is of some concern to me, and the potential for going against entities with regard to the back taxes. I'm not familiar with what's the limitation in terms of what a municipality or taxing authority can. Do you know that, how far they can go back to collect back property taxes?
I don't know that there is any statute of limitations against attempting to collect property taxes. I think that in practice, most municipalities would probably only reach back for a few years rather than try to go back to the beginning of time. But I bring no particular expertise on the assessor's work of collecting taxes on behalf of a municipality.
Do you have any idea how many entities like Columbus Park there are in the state, nonprofit housing authorities?
I do not have an exact count, but I know that hundreds of units of low-income housing would be implicated by a negative decision here. That I do know. It's a significant number of units that would be adversely affected. And for that reason, I would strongly urge the court not to adopt a holding that will kill off the likes of Columbus Park Housing and similar nonprofit organizations that provide affordable housing for the poor. The task of addressing this aspect of poverty, or any aspect of poverty, is indeed a very broad one. And we really need all the arrows in the quiver, whether it is nonprofit providers of low-income housing like Columbus Park, for-profit Section 8 operators who have an entirely different set of economic motivations that makes it attractive for them to be involved, or municipal housing authorities. And I think that by affirming the Court of Appeals, the court would be adopting a view that is in harmony with the intent of the statute to promote charitable activities. Again, the Catholic Women's Club case made that very clear, and that will not call into question a whole array of other exemptions where benevolent activity includes offering occupancy for consideration.
You don't think that's the job of the legislature?
The legislature has provided an exemption for benevolent organizations. And Columbus Park Housing, as we've pointed out, really meets all the requirements for the benevolent organization exemption. And it is the task of this court to construe the statute and to apply public policy considerations to its construction.
But when I looked at the briefs, both parties, I didn't find a lot of legislative intent behind Section 70.11.4 from the briefs. In other words,
I think that there just isn't a lot, Justice Wilcox. You're looking at 150 years of tinkering and patching, and many times things just appear in the statute or moved or taken out or whatever. And,
Kinnaman,
yes.
This court should agree with you. Shouldn't we just adopt the Court of Appeals decision? Or is there anything in the Court of Appeals decision you think might strike a wrong note that you would amend or rewrite?
I think the Court of Appeals decision is a very narrow decision. I think the Court of Appeals has said that we view the leasing language in the preamble as applying to leases to for-profits or leases for pecuniary gain, and construe that to apply in those circumstances and not to apply to other types of arrangements, and particularly where the leasing arrangements are with the objects of the organization, the exempt organization's benevolence. That view does no violence to the statute. It doesn't call into question in one degree or another a whole array of other exemption statutes, and is really an entirely appropriate subject for this court to address as a matter of statutory construction. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kinnaman. Mr. May, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the rules of construction for tax exemptions should dictate the outcome in this case. The rules that this court has set forth and the legislative pronouncement in 70.109.
Would you address the hypothetical that I raised, counsel? Could Columbus Park preserve its exemption here if it leased each of these properties to another exempt organization, which would then sublease to the Section 8 tenants?
I think the problem with that scenario is that the requirement of the lessee is that it qualify for an exemption if it owned the property. So then you look at, okay, if it owned the property and it leased it to somebody, it would lose its exemption unless that tenant qualifies for an exemption. So I don't think you can end run the statute simply by putting in a benevolent association as the lessee to then sublease the property, because then the sublease lessees become the relevant inquiry. Would they qualify for an exemption?
Well, what about a public housing authority?
If you lease to the public housing authority, the public housing authority qualifies for an exemption. So,
right, but then it leases to people of low income.
I believe, Your Honor, that because there is a separate statute for public housing authorities granting them an exemption, the pilot section, that the rules of construction are different for them. I think they get a liberal construction in favor of exemption because they're subject to the pilot.
But, counsel, you're reading that introductory language, what everybody refers to as a preamble, right?
Yes.
To cover sub 4, right?
Sub 4 refers to the preamble, yes.
All right. What about 18?
18 doesn't refer to the preamble. You could take the position that if it doesn't refer to it, there are no separate rules, but I think the preamble doesn't lend itself to that construction. I think the preamble lends itself to the construction that unless that subsection says it doesn't apply, it does apply.
But 18 doesn't say it doesn't apply.
That's correct, Your Honor. So
you got a little problem there.
Got a problem that's created by one statute that gives you an exemption and one statute that says you don't have it, and the statute that subjects them to a pilot, I would submit this Court has said there's a different set of rules in that case, that you look to harmonize that problem by giving them an exemption because they're subject to the pilot.
Is it stipulated by the parties that the tenants are subject to a lease in this case? And is the lease signed leases in the record? Are the signed leases in the record?
Actually, there is no copy of the lease that is properly in the record. The city submitted an exhibit attached to its brief, which it represented was a representative lease, but that was not authenticated by an affidavit. So,
is it stipulated to at all? I mean, is it in the...
In the stipulation of facts, Your Honor, stipulation refers to none of the leased properties at issue.
And what are you referring to?
Paragraph 43, 44 refer to the leased properties.
Okay, thank you.
There's also a discussion of the leasehold income, which...
If there were no lease, if there were no signed lease in this case, I mean, Wisconsin seems to me as long exempted from taxation the real property of a benevolent association used exclusively for the benevolent purpose and not for profit. You know, so if it's a benevolent association, if the real property is used exclusively for the benevolent purpose and not for profit, that there's tax exemption of that real property, and that the kicker here is the lease.
I think the appropriate inquiry would be would form the substance over the form. The M&I case counsel cited, actually the Court of Appeals didn't say that the residential agreements in that case were leases. They said that you can have a residential agreement that isn't a lease. And in a footnote, they specifically said they're not going to address whether the residential agreement also qualifies as a lease.
Well, do we know that in this record? We don't have the lease in the record, you're saying? Although I saw something marked as Exhibit 1, but unsigned.
Your Honor, Well, I was not the author of that brief. The exhibit was not authenticated, and there was no affidavit saying this is a representative sample, so I don't think it's properly part of the record. There is no lease other than that one that's part of the record.
One of the things I did see in the stipulation is the stipulation that the property, the low-cost shelter to individuals, is made available by the plaintiffs, and the individuals might otherwise be homeless. And that's a stipulation. I think that's one of the reasons it's causing me to squirm a bit, that you've stipulated that they might be homeless if you win. It's kind of a hollow victory, at least for some.
Well, I think compassion for the recipients of benevolent associations is an appropriate emotion, but it doesn't shed light on whether or not they qualify for an exemption. We could look at the legislature's decision to have no requirements whatsoever, no restrictions whatsoever on leasing sports stadiums or nonprofit youth hockey associations' property. We could say, we can ask ourselves, well, that doesn't seem to make much sense if you have to, a benevolent association has restrictions. But the legislature chose to do that. And we are left with interpreting what the legislature did. And I think if you give a reasonable construction to the legislative language, there's simply no way that these properties qualify for exemptions.
What you're really arguing, aren't you, is that who should pay for the services Milwaukee renders? Is it, I'm sorry, Kenosha, is it are the property owners in Kenosha who are going to have to share these costs? Or do you impose these costs on a benevolent association who is leasing the property and force them to acquire more money either through charitable donations or through federal contributions or state contributions if there are any? Isn't that the real issue in the case?
I don't think that's the city's prerogative. I think that's a legislative decision. We're left with what the legislature said the rules are. And yes, every time you give an exemption to one class of property owners, everyone else has to make up the difference.
And that's why you want a strict and reasonable construction to impose the property tax on all owners of the property rather than eliminate some.
That, I believe, is what our obligation is as the city.
Chief, I need a clarification.
Yes.
You were using the term pilot a couple minutes ago. I didn't understand what that term
I'm
meant.
I'm sorry. It's payments in lieu of taxation.
This is what the city may charge.
Under 66.112, I can't recall exactly, but under Chapter 66, yes.
Thank you, Mr. DeMay. Before I can call this hearing to a close, let me say on behalf of the court that we recognize that today is 9/11, 2 years after the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, and that the court in 2001, 2002, and now 2003 has continued to conduct business on this day, recognizing the grief and by not only the victims and their families, but by all of us about that. We do that and ask you to do that in recognition that it is the peaceful settlement of disputes that we recognize today, and the horrors of violence that we experienced in 2001 and before that, in which we all continue to experience around the world. So we hope that we all keep this in mind as we go about our regular business today, and that we all stand for the rule of law. With that, I close the hearing on 02-0699 Columbus Park Housing Corporation versus City of Kenosha. The court is in recess until 1:45.